It's a week of fear and loathing in United States democracy.
This will be an election of Kavanaugh, the caravan, law and order, and common sense.
Next Tuesday, American voters head to the polls for the midterm elections, and with the Democrats vying to snatch the House of Representatives from the Republicans, the vote is shaping up to be a referendum on not just President Donald Trump, but on the health of United States politics.
Well, I think I've been toned down. You want to know the truth? I could really tone it up.
The last few weeks of the campaign have been marred by chaos and tragedy.
This atrocity was a chilling act of mass murder. It was an act of hatred. And above all, it was an act of evil.
A massacre at a Jewish synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, killing 11, has reignited accusations of Trump's anti-Semitism and led to the politicization of a tragedy. When Trump arrived in Pittsburgh on Tuesday, many officials and residents made clear his visit was not welcome.
We'd like to ask President Trump to please stop with all of the hate speech and please try to bring our country together.
Words of hate are unwelcome in Pittsburgh.
Democratic leaders and members of the media were sent pipe bombs in the mail by a Trump supporter. It caused mass panic and sparked fresh fears for those criticising the president. And as the caravan of Central American refugee migrants, running 7 miles long, edges closer to the US border, some Republicans have used this as validation for their border protection position.
I'm willing to send the military to defend our southern border.
From the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. Later on, we'll be joined by senior business columnist Stephen Bartholomews to discuss the volatility in our stock market and how much of that is driven by what's happening in the US. But first,
we have seen an effort by the media in recent hours to use the sinister actions of one individual to score political points against me and the Republican Party.
Matthew Knott has been covering one of the most scrutinized midterms in US history from our Washington Bureau. Nick O'Malley is our former US correspondent and senior writer. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hi, Tori.
First to you, Matt. What's the atmosphere in the United States this week leading up to the midterms?
Oh, well, as you say, midterms usually would not be so exciting. This is the first chance that people are getting 2 years into the Trump presidency to have a say about how they feel. But then the past month, there's just been so much going on, from the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings to the caravan of migrants that has been going through Mexico, to the attacks that we've seen in the past week on the synagogue and on the pipe bomb sent to Democrats. It's just created this really intense atmosphere, and even people who may not usually be so interested in politics are very plugged in right now to the midterms.
Nick, you covered the 2016 election of Donald Trump, you covered the 2012 election, and you've observed many midterms before. Does this one feel different?
Yeah, in that we're talking about it. The atmosphere isn't just intense, it's ugly. And I think part of the reason for that is, well, obviously it's Donald Trump, because one thing that's often not observed from the outside is that the role of the president, he's not just executive, he's not just the seat of executive authority, he's also the head of state. And in normal circumstances, in normal presidencies, it would be his job at times like this, when 11 Jews have been murdered in a place of worship, and when pipe bombs have been sent to high-profile politicians and supporters, it would be the role of the presidency to come out and to tell people that America is one unified country that supports and loves all of its citizens. And Trump just isn't doing it. He's just attacking.
So, Matt, is that sense palpable there in the US that people are afraid?
Definitely. There's a very negative atmosphere. And going around talking to people in different places, it doesn't matter what their politics are. Just when you start talking to them and say, what do you think of politics right now? They just groan and they say, it's so ugly. We're so divided. I just hate the way our country is going. And they could be pro-Trump, they could be anti-Trump, but people are not happy with the political system here. And also the thing you don't see from the outside, particularly from Australia, is the huge amounts of money that are going in to these races all over the country. People who are watching TV and listening to the radio in their car are getting flooded with so much advertising, much more than we would get at home. And they're just sick of hearing about it. They're sick of the attacks on each other, and they want it to be over.
So are they actually talking about any big issues, or is it just personal?
Yes, they are talking about issues. A lot of it does come down for people to character. Other issues coming up, Democrats are really trying to run on healthcare, which is ironic because in the last midterms that was seen as a negative for them. Obamacare was not popular. The Republicans are really trying to focus on the economy. But I must say, those issues are being swamped out by the president and by these big cultural flashpoints that are happening.
So, Nick, let's talk about the economy. Low unemployment.
Yeah, the unemployment's under 4%. So, and the other point is that America is not in a major armed conflict. So in any other time, the governing party should be romping it in, and they're not at the moment. And I think part of the reason is because there are a lot of things Donald Trump can't talk about now. There might be members of the Republican Party who want to talk about the economy. And there are many who hoped to run on the tax cuts they managed to get through, but they've proved to be unpopular. So they can't talk about tax cuts. They can't talk about foreign affairs because that brings up a trade war with China, which isn't popular in the Midwest, and it brings up a Russia investigation, and it brings up a friendship with Saudi Arabia, which has just butchered someone in a basement. So really what Trump has decided anyway is that he's going to talk about race. He's going to talk about this caravan. He's going to talk about, he just raised with one of our former colleagues.
Can we talk about that caravan for a minute? What do you mean?
So there is a group of about 7,000 would-be asylum seekers walking towards the United States border from Central America. They're doing so in a caravan because it's a safer way to travel. They're about 1,000 kilometres or 1,000 miles, I think, last I checked, from the US border. But Trump is seeking to whip this up into an election issue by saying it's a threat. He's deployed, I think, 6,000 troops to the southern border as though these people who are on the other side of Mexico pose an existential threat to the United States. And this is, I mean, Matt might have a different view, but it strikes me that this is because he understands that the last election, he was able to run against Hillary Clinton, who was not an effective campaigner and who was not a popular politician, whereas this time it's all about him. So he has to speak straight to his core and his core constituency. He understands were motivated by his very, at times, brutal racial politics. America First and some of his supporters understand that to mean white middle America First.
Matt, how are people responding to the sort of Donald Trump versus immigrant children situation that he's created? I mean, there was very ugly scenes a few months ago of children being separated from their parents, which he's tried to defuse now. But now, as Nick pointed out, he has said that he wants to use executive powers to take away the citizenship of children who were born in the United States to illegal immigrants.
Yes, no, I don't think he can do that at all. I mean, it seems that under the Constitution, experts would tell you that isn't possible. But he sees immigration as very much the issue that he wants to talk about, that it works in his favour, and that it's an uncomfortable issue for Democrats because they don't want to be seen as encouraging illegal immigration, encouraging people to come undocumented, but yet they also are very dependent on Latino voters to come out and vote for them. So it's that ultimate wedge issue, similar to what happens often with Labor at home around refugees. It's an uncomfortable issue for Democrats to deal with because it splits the members of their voting coalition. So they would rather not be talking about immigration at all. They would rather be talking about healthcare and wages and those bread and butter issues.
Let's talk about women for a minute. Since Donald Trump was elected, we've had the women's marches, we've had the Me Too movement. How mobilised are women in this election?
The gender divide right now is absolutely huge. I don't think there's ever been anything like it in American politics before. I was just looking at the approval rating. So Donald Trump has about a 4% positive approval rating with men and a minus 25% disapproval rating with women. And that's just not normal at all. And that's reflected in the way people have responded in terms of activism to his presidency. After he was elected, all these groups popped up, these left-wing Tea Party style groups all over the country. And the thing you find when you when you see them is that they're run almost entirely by women. Women are the leaders and women are most of the members in these groups. And they're people who were not politically active before. They might have been teachers or librarians or nurses, but they were so appalled by the fact that Trump got elected. They've become politicized. And so they're out there door knocking, they're out there making phone calls, they're really involved in politics. And meanwhile, on the male side, there was quite a strong flowback of men towards the Republicans from the Kavanaugh issue around this whole question of a man being unfairly accused of sexual assault.
Evangelical Christians seem to be Trump supporters quite vehemently, even though Trump isn't a particularly Christian human. Donald Trump was told he was not welcome to go and visit that synagogue where that awful massacre happened, even though his daughter is in fact Jewish. Nick, what's your take on where religion plays into all of this?
Well, the evangelicals are stuck by Trump since he became the presumptive nominee. And one of the reasons for that is he signaled to them very early on that despite his own behaviour, he would ensure very conservative voices in the Supreme Court. And he's provided that with two nominees so far. And it looks as though Roe versus Wade, the right to abortion in America, might be challenged. That's what the evangelical community in America wanted. So you hear them justifying his own behaviour by saying, you know, God sent us this man who isn't perfect, but look what he's done. On the Jewish side of things, there's a real divide because the man accused of this massacre, he's not a supporter of Trump, but the reason why he, according to his social media posts, the reason why he hates Trump is because Trump isn't tough enough on refugees. The reason why he attacked this synagogue is because he hates, he says, a Jewish group which aids immigration. So a lot of Jews in particular are recognizing that perhaps one of the reasons for his inflamed hatred is in fact Trump's rhetoric on immigration. And then you have this divide within the Jewish community. Trump has directed the United States, well, has moved the United States embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which for generations, or for at least a generation, American presidents have promised to do while running and then failed to do. Trump just went and did it. That wins massive support from APAC, the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is a very conservative Jewish lobby group. It brings in boatloads of money from donors like Sheldon Adelson. But as Matt said earlier, the general Jewish population in America tends to vote Democratic, and I would guess in this race would be driven even further in that direction.
Matt, after the 2016 election, the media learned the hard way that there's sort of two versions of what goes on in American politics. The version that, you know, commentators in New York and Washington go on about, and then the version that the rest of the country are living as their reality. And everyone was quite shocked to discover that those two versions were quite different. So you spent quite a bit of time on the road talking to people outside of Washington and New York. Tell us about that trip.
One of the things that really struck me was the big media narrative, and it's kind of true in one sense, is about the red and blue America and the divide between Democrats and Republicans and how far apart they are and can't agree on anything. And that is true among the very loyal members of those parties. But when I got out there speaking to people in places like New Mexico and Iowa, particularly people who voted for Trump, you sense a lot of confusion, ambivalence, uncertainty about what's going on and what's going to happen. So I remember speaking to a man in New Mexico who is retired and is on Social Security, very much working class, and he voted for Obama and then switched to Trump. He wanted a businessman in there, someone who was not a traditional politician, and he likes some of the things that he's done. He likes being tougher on trade deals. He likes getting the NATO allies to pay more. But then he's been disappointed that Trump hasn't done enough for working class people. He's done more for the rich, in his view, rather than working people like him, and is kind of regretting it and not sure how he would vote the next time. And you get that sense from some people. They really dislike some things that Trump is doing. They like other things, like the fact he met with Kim Jong-un. Even Democrats will say, well, someone needed to go in and throw out the rule book and just meet with this crazy dictator and try and get something done. He gets a lot of credit for that.
But he didn't get anything done. Nothing happened apart from the meeting.
No.
This is the great thing about the Trump presidency. So much of it's, I call it presidential theatre.
It's show business.
He looks like a president, but nothing's done.
Yes, and but yet I do find he gets tremendous credit for it out there, even though certainly no final deal is done. And I don't think people were really that interested in North Korea before and the intricacies of diplomacy, but he gets a lot of credit for people for that. In certain places, the wall is a very popular idea.
The wall that doesn't exist.
Yes, a wall that doesn't
exist.
This
is the wall on the border with Mexico.
Yeah, but it's still a potent image for people that they have, and they will tell you, I voted Democrat. I still like the Democrats. We should probably have a wall, though. I like the idea of a wall. You still hear that a lot, and they're not that worried that it's not being built. It's an idea that is very powerful to people.
Is anyone raising the Russia investigation with you in your travels?
Nobody, absolutely nobody. It's not coming up at all. Now, part of the reason could be that the news has gone quiet on that front because we're expecting the Mueller report to come out pretty soon after the elections, that he'll time it. But no, I don't think that is an issue that is really motivating people either way. Part of the problem, perhaps, I know it's annoyed Trump that it's gone on so long, but I think an element of fatigue has set in. You know, it's 2 years now since the last election and this inquiry is going on. It's not something that was top of mind at all. No one brought it up with me. If Mueller finds something quite explosive, then that will obviously be huge. But no, it's not something that is top of mind out there for most people.
Mueller's obviously deliberately gone quiet over the past couple of months as well because he wants to avoid entering into the political arena. But it is amazing that we live in a world where an investigation with those stakes just doesn't make the news at the moment.
So do either of you have the courage to make a prediction on what's going to happen next Tuesday?
I think the
wisdom not to.
I've done this before. most people are willing enough to say that it doesn't look like the Republicans can hold the House. One thing that's interesting that we haven't talked about, though, is these are elections across the country. There'll be about 700 state seats which swap hands. There'll be, Matt, you might correct me, but over a dozen state houses will change sides, and that could have a huge impact on the 2020 elections because it's the states that manage the elections. It's the states that write districts. It's the states that write voter laws. And in marginal states districts, that's hugely important.
Matt, what's your sense?
Yeah, I agree. I think it would be shocking if the Democrats didn't take back the House. They only need 23 seats, which should totally be achievable. And if they don't, it will cause a massive, massive amount of soul searching. So I would expect them to take the House, the Senate, not to take over the Senate, maybe to go back a seat or two, but for that to stay pretty stable. And as Nick said, some of the state races are so important and really interesting. What's happening in states like Florida and Georgia, where you couldn't imagine an African-American Democrat winning, those candidates there have a really big shot. And that's going to be hugely influential around some of the policy areas like guns and healthcare and drawing the districts and running the elections in the next presidential campaign. It seems like Democrats are doing really well in some of the states where you wouldn't expect them to win.
One other thing that some glum Democrats have pointed out to me is if they win the House, and they need to win the House, it's actually a benefit, or it could turn out to be a benefit for the White House. Because for the past 2 years anyway, Trump, who has been in perpetual campaign mode, has been campaigning against the ghost of Hillary Clinton. Whereas if there's Democrats in the House, he can blame anything that happens, anything that goes wrong, any failure of his or of the Republican Party can be sheeted home to Democrats in the House. It gives him an opposition to run against in 2020, which he doesn't really have at the moment.
Matt, Nick, these are historic times you're writing in. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Matt Knott from Washington and Nick O'Malley from Sydney. This week, Matt has written a series of in-depth reports from the ground in the US. They'll be published in our papers and online over coming days as Tuesday's vote approaches.
McClymont here from the investigative team at The Herald. Much of what we do is giving a voice to the unheard and holding the powerful to account. Whether it's rampant underpayment in the fast food industry, sexual harassment in the entertainment world, or uncovering Australia's recycling crisis, our coverage proves the value of investigative journalism. Good reporting needs supporters. Subscribe today for just 50 cents a day. Just look for subscribe on any of our websites.
When the US share market shudders, so does ours. The Australian All Ordinaries is down more than 10% from the beginning of August. Stephen Bartholomews is a senior business columnist for The Herald and The Age. Steve, things started getting really hairy on our stock market about halfway through October. What's going on?
Most of what's going on is going on in the States and on Wall Street. Our markets always take the lead from what happens overnight in Wall Street. So when you wake up each morning, if Wall Street's fallen, you can expect ours to fall too. There might be some local influences. I mean, the political instability in Canberra is clearly not helpful. But our economy's generally been growing quite strongly. Our corporate profits have been okay this season. So there's no particular domestic reason why the market would implode. So therefore, you look to what happened on Wall Street over the last month or so.
So what has happened on Wall Street?
It's lost 10% in a month, wiped out the entire year's gains. So it's gone from a record to back to where it started the year. And there's a bunch of reasons why that's happened. Some of them are kind of short-term and political. There's a lot of heat in the lead-up to the midterms. But there are some much longer-term, more macro influences as well.
So how bad is this? When was the last time that it fell that much in a month?
I think you'd have to go back to probably the financial crisis period to have seen that this sort of fall. It's been precipitous. With no single trigger, just a general confluence of some fairly unsettling developments on trade. You know, the trade conflict with China as it's escalating and as it's starting to impact. You know, the US has just gone through their corporate profit season. And most of the companies are reporting strong earnings. You know, earnings growth for the market overall in the States is about 20%, which is phenomenal. However, the expectation next year is it'll fall to something in the mid-single digits, 5% or so. And you say, well, why is that? Well, the companies are all saying, A, the impact of the sugar hit from the tax cuts, the Trump tax cuts, will wane. But more particularly, almost every company, large company with international operations that's reported, has said we're starting to feel the effects of the tariffs. Our input costs are rising, and so we either pass that on to consumers and lose sales, or we digest it ourselves and we lose profit. And it'll get worse because Trump's already promised that the 10% tariff today on $200 billion of imports from China is going to go to 25% in January, and he's threatening another $257 billion. So the entirety of China's exports to the States could be covered by tariffs unless China surrenders.
So there's an enormous amount of fear, but also they're responding to the reality of what's already happened.
What's happened and what's likely to happen in the not-too-distant future. I mean, the tariffs clearly are going to have a big impact, not just on China, and therefore flow back to us as well, because if China slows, so will we, but on the States itself. The other big influence in this, and I think it's probably, in some respects, the biggest long-term influence, is that during the financial crisis, the Fed Reserve and other central banks, but the Fed Reserve particularly, dramatically expanded its balance sheet from $900 billion to about $4.5 trillion and lowered US interest rates basically to zero. They started very late in 2015 raising their rates in sort of 25 basis point increments. And they've done that now eight times with an expectation there'll be another one this year and probably three more at least next year. So US interest rates are rising, which is not good for stock markets. And at the same time, they're starting to shrink that balance sheet at a rate of about $50 billion a month, which takes liquidity out of the system. In other words, you know, monetary policy is tightening quite rapidly and significantly in the States. And if you believe, as I do, that it was that very loose monetary policy, very cheap money and readily available money that inflated stock markets and property markets around the world, as that liquidity is withdrawn, you'd assume the markets would deflate, and I think that's an element of what we're seeing.
So what's the thinking behind removing that liquidity? Is it to bring down debt?
I think they're trying to normalise monetary policy because, A, they can. I think they recognise that it's caused some bubbles, if you like, in financial asset markets. But also there's a concern about inflation. Now, and there's an interaction here with the trade policies because tariffs increase costs to US consumers. So it creates inflation. The US unemployment rate is at historic lows. It hasn't been this low in living memory. So the labour market's really tight. The US economy has been growing at close to 4%. Trump would like to see it at 5%, but that would be a disaster. They'd run into a wall. And I think the Fed's genuinely concerned that in circumstances where the tax cuts are pouring oil on an economy which is already firing on all cylinders, there's a real danger that the thing will explode. We'll have an outbreak of real inflation in the States. And so they're trying to get ahead of the game by raising rates and tightening monetary policy.
Why are the tech stocks copping it so badly? By Tuesday this week, Amazon had lost $230 billion off its value.
Yes, it topped $1 trillion back in early September and has lost $250 billion in a month. It's staggering. The tech stocks, I think, illustrate the larger problem that, you know, I've referred to the inflation of financial asset prices. The US market, until the sell-off started just over a month ago, was being priced at about 20 times earnings. And historically, you'd look for something more like 15 times earnings. So it's been significantly overpriced relative to history. So it was already priced for absolute perfection. And clearly, there's some imperfections that have just emerged. The tech stocks were selling at 60, 70, 80 times earnings because people had this expectation they just continue to grow exponentially into global dominance and the revenues and profits that would generate. The minute you get some negatives, and there have been negatives generally in terms of interest rates and so on, those sort of multiples leverage the impact on the downside. And so most of the tech stocks, you know, the FANGs as they call them, so it's Facebook, Alphabet, which is the Google parent, Netflix and so on, most of those have seen their share prices fall quite dramatically, much bigger, much larger falls than the overall market, simply because they had been priced so much more aggressively than the overall market.
So where do you think we are in this cycle, Steve? Is this just the beginning of a bloodbath?
Not necessarily. I mean, it could be, but not necessarily. I suppose it depends on how intelligently and delicately the Fed continues to tighten monetary policy. In the past, confronted with the possibility of a market shock, the Fed's backed off. If they were to do that today, then, you know, we'd be back on track to have, you know, share prices would keep rising and everyone would feel really optimistic. I've had this view for a very long time that the central banks generally left the spigots open for too long. You know, we used to talk about kicking the can down the road. They've kicked it a long, long way. You know, with these conditions, these historically unprecedented loose money conditions have been in place now for a decade. So you'd expect that to get out of this situation, it's going to take, if they're careful, several years of tightening. If they overdo it, we'll have market implosions. If rates in the States rise too quickly and too high, it'll put a real dampener on the US economy. It'll give it a real shock. It'll hit a brick wall. It was always going to be a difficult moment when the central banks tried to unwind these policies they've had in place for a decade.
So is there anything that the people in charge of monetary policy here can do to inoculate us from this?
The RBA's done the sensible thing and it's done nothing. So it's left rates at what are, for us, historically low levels. They could do, if they had to, what the Fed's done and start buying bonds and mortgages to put more liquidity back into the system and to keep rates very, very low. There are other unconventional measures that EB and the Bank of Japan have used that you could use in an emergency. But I think at the moment they're doing the sensible thing, just keeping rates where they are at historically low levels. They and the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority have tried to take some of the risk out of the system with the measures they've taken on, for instance, you know, investment property lending and the like, tried to take risk out of the banking system. So generally our regulators have been quite sensible, and because we didn't have to do the extreme things that they did in North America and Europe, we don't have quite the same challenges in terms of policy. But at the end of the day, the other thing that we've got that is quite valuable is a floating exchange rate. So the dollar will adjust and has, as I think everyone's seen, has already adjusted. So we're down at the 71-cent level, whereas not that long ago we were above 80 cents.
So just finally, how worried should Australian investors be? I mean, people are looking at their retirement savings now and a lot of them would be invested in the share market and a lot of them would be invested in the property market and they must be feeling a bit insecure. How should they be feeling about it?
I think they should be watchful rather than fearful. I don't have an investment advisor's license, so I'm not going to give specific advice. But no, it's time to be wary because we're clearly on the verge of something which is either going to be the normalisation of the settings in which markets operate or something rather less pleasant. And so, yeah, it's an interesting moment, one to be quite watchful.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Thanks, Tori.
Thanks to our guests, Matthew Knott, Nick O'Malley and Stephen Bartholomews. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Support the work we do. Our subscribers get unlimited access to award-winning, independent journalism, plus exclusive behind-the-scenes stories you can't get anywhere else. Follow the link in our show bio to subscribe today. This episode was produced by David Escort and Nicole Presell. Technical assistance from David McMillan and Cormac Lally. And Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.
Whoever's in the White House loses the midterm. You lose the midterm. We're going to go through nothing but fights. We're going to be fighting to keep what you have. They're going to want to take it away. You got to get out. You can't be complacent.